compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show. Thank you for listening. My number is 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Please note that October is the month of the Rosary, and we invite you to celebrate that with us here on the Family Rosary Across America every evening at 7 p.m. Central, where you can pray the Rosary with and for families nationwide. Our families need prayers, and families that pray together stay together. So there's no better time than right now to start praying together. Join us on your local Relevant Radio station or through the mobile app or online at relevantradio.com/Family Rosary Across America. Our Lady of the Rosary, pray for us. 888-914-9149. We'll go now to Kristen in Texas. Good morning, Kristen. Welcome.
Good morning, Patrick. My question is regarding the different rites of the Catholic Church that some callers were asking about last week. I always sort of, and I think you said that's Latin. Sorry that I don't know more correctly how to say that, but I always sort of thought that was the one true church that Jesus started. And so I felt really secure in my Catholic faith. But now that I'm hearing that there's other rites and things, it's kind of making me confused. And I was wondering, which is the one that Jesus originally started?
Okay. Well, the church that Jesus originally started is the Catholic Church. And the Catholic Church is seen in different lands, different areas, as having different expressions of the one true faith, the faith once for all delivered to the saints. So that is the church that Christ established. And think about it this way, Kristen. So on the day of Pentecost, Jesus has ascended to heaven, and the Holy Spirit comes upon the apostles and Our Lady and those who were in the upper room where Jesus celebrated the Last Supper. And what happens? They go out into the streets and they start preaching the gospel in a very exuberant and excited, energetic way. And we see a miracle take place. So the miracle, first of all, is that people who are visiting Jerusalem from all over the world at that time, the known world, they could hear the apostles, in some cases, preaching in their own language, even though the apostles were not preaching in that language. They were preaching probably in Aramaic or Greek, perhaps. Mm-hmm. These people who didn't speak Aramaic or Greek, they could understand it. Miracle. Or another aspect of this was that the apostles were given the gift of preaching in languages that they didn't themselves know, but they now were able to preach in those languages. So what we see right there is that there is, at the very outset of the beginning of the church, we see this, what's called pluriformity. We see a variety of languages, a variety of cultures, a variety of different lands that these people were from. And they all together were experiencing for the first time this outpouring of the Holy Spirit and the birth of the church, which led to, as you know, from Acts chapter 2, 3,000 people were baptized and brought into the Catholic Church that very day. Big start to the whole process, right? So what you see there is now people from Idumea and Arabia and all these other lands that are mentioned, what's going to happen? They're going to go back to their homes in due time. Next week, the week after that, however long they stayed in Jerusalem, they weren't going to live there. What were they going to do? They were going to go back to where they came from and share the gospel there. So as always happens when it comes to human events, is that the customs and the language and the culture of that area would shape the way in which this one true church had been revealed. And so customs would start to arise. So when they would go back to Arabia, for example, and I don't know that they were necessarily speaking Arabic as such, but probably some precursor to it. Well, then now suddenly they're going to start praying and teaching about Jesus. And if they're priests who are ordained, celebrating the Holy Eucharist in that local language. And so customs begin to develop. Okay. So this is true in the Greek-speaking world. It's true in the Latin-speaking world. It's true in general. But it's still the one true church. It's all the same church, but it has different ways of manifesting this in language, etc., in various places. So that's ultimately what the rites derive from. They derive from the geographic localities where the apostles visited and they planted the church in these different places. And so, let's say in the Greek-speaking world, this is where the Byzantine rite is closely associated with, it is how the church was visible in that place and in those ways. The Latin rite church, which is what you and I'm presuming you're a Latin rite Catholic, as I am, so we are in this country the predominant, by far, numerically, the predominant rite of the Catholic Church. But the Byzantine Catholics are no less Catholic than we are. And we are no less Catholic than the Byzantine Catholics or any of the other rites. And I don't know if you heard me mention it on the show yesterday or the day before, but I used an analogy. It must have been Friday or yesterday. I used an analogy of an orchestra. Okay. Did you hear the analogy of the orchestra where they're all playing the same song, but each of the instruments is playing a different part of that? Did you hear that one?
Yes.
Okay. So I think that is one way to help.
What was the one about the family? And you clarified it right now because I was confused and I was thinking that like some of the other rites broke off from the original, but that's not it at all. You cleared it up and I was thinking it was something like that.
Well, actually, no, it is something like that. So let me clarify it further.
Oh.
So don't worry. It's all good. So in the 11th century, the phenomenon that took place, we call it the Great Schism, was when what we think of today as the Eastern Orthodox churches, so primarily the Greek Orthodox Church, the Coptic Orthodox Church, later on the Russian Orthodox Church, but the Orthodox churches as we know them today, they were all part of the Catholic Church originally. And when this schism took place and this break effectively happened where they said, we're leaving. But they didn't really say that. They basically said, you guys left us. So that's part of the polemic. The Eastern Orthodox churches, they claim that the Catholics left them. In reality, it's not that. The Eastern Orthodox churches broke communion with the Bishop of Rome. So what happened is that persisted, that circumstance persisted for centuries. Until in the 1600s, some of these groups, some of these churches that were in these erstwhile Eastern Orthodox settings, they wanted to return to the Catholic Church. They wanted reunion. And so when these bishops and priests and deacons and faithful did reunite, and it wasn't like the whole Greek Orthodox Church, but sections of these folk came back to the Catholic Church, and they were permitted by the church, which is how it should be, to preserve their rite, to preserve their language, to preserve the way in which they celebrate the divine liturgy, which is what they would refer to what we call the Mass, and their customs and things of that nature. So you are actually, when you see a Byzantine divine liturgy, what you're seeing is what it would look like if the Eastern Orthodox churches did return to the Catholic Church, because some of them did, and that's what those rites express. You see, so they're in union with the church, but they had to come back into communion with the church after having left it. Do you see the distinction there?
I do, and I should have known everything's more complicated, but you have a good way of explaining it, so thank you, and I hope you have a good day.
Me too. Thank you, Kristen. And if you're interested, there's a good book by Father Aidan Nichols, N-I-C-H-O-L-S. It's called Rome and the Eastern Churches. And he's a scholar at, not at Oxford, he's a scholar at Cambridge University, and he's an historian. So anybody who's interested in kind of a calm and dispassionate analysis of what all happened, that's a good book. Check it out. We'll go now to Christina in Albuquerque. Hi, Christina.
Good morning. My priest in church this last Sunday said he's been asked to speak to Jehovah's Witnesses at one of the hospitals, and he's really nervous. Okay. He doesn't feel like he's going to be able to defend the faith as well as they defend theirs, or the Bible, rather. And so I was hoping to get some information as to where I might direct him or give him a book or something.
Yeah, I would recommend go to the Catholic Answers website, catholic.com, and he can avail himself of a lot of free things. So the free things would include tracts and articles from their publication. And those are all free, and there's plenty of it there. So he can get information about how to talk to Jehovah's Witnesses about the truth of the Trinity. They deny that. Or the divinity of Jesus Christ. They deny that. Or how to talk to them about more arcane details like blood transfusions, their opposition to that, or their opposition to birthdays and celebrations, or articles that detail all their many false prophecies. They claim to be the faithful and discreet slave that Jesus talked about in the Gospels, and yet they're not the individual people who are going door to door. I don't mean them, but the organization, the Watchtower Bible and Tract Society, historically has proven time and time and time again to be a false prophet by prophesying with definitive time frames Armageddon and the return of Jesus, and they've been wrong over and over and over and over again. And by 1975, the last time they tried it, and of course it didn't happen, they stopped doing it. So he could be familiarizing himself with that. He can familiarize himself with the egregious mistranslations that they have in their New World Translation of the Bible and how it's intentionally revised to avoid the clear biblical meaning in matters like the divinity of Jesus. So there's a lot there, and thankfully Catholic Answers has done a lot of work over the years, and those are at his fingertips. Now, if he's interested, I myself did a digital download with a man named Leonard Kratian, and he was a Jehovah's Witness for many years before returning to practice of Christianity, and I believe he was on his way into the Catholic Church. I've just lost track of him over time. And we did a four-hour discussion, he and I, in which we went through meticulously the false prophecies, the doctrinal claims that they make, the mistranslations of the Bible, but more importantly, the techniques that Jehovah's Witnesses are trained to use to talk to Catholics, for example, and the kinds of arguments that they would use. And Leonard Kratian shows how Catholics can respond intelligently and biblically so that some progress can be made. Because they're not our enemies, but we need to speak up and defend the truth. And they're prepared to defend their way of looking at the Bible. Catholics need to do the same. So if he's interested, all he needs to do to access that is go to relevantradio.com/Patrick and click on links and then go to the section where my books are. And he can find that digital download there. And if he were to listen to that, I think it would also be very helpful to him.
Okay, and how do you spell Leonard's last name, please?
Kratian, C-R-A-C-H-R-E-T-I-E-N-E, Kratian.
I-E-N-E, got it. Thank you so much. I think this will be a world of help for him.
I'm glad. Well, thanks, Christine. I appreciate it. 888-914-9149. Now we'll go to Jose in Chicago. Hi, Jose.
Hi, Patrick. Viva Cristo Rey.
Viva!
I was just calling. I have this friend, you know, he's Protestant, and he was just asking me, you know, the timeline between Jesus Christ and the Catholic Church. So, you know, we keep going back and forth, you know, and I'm like, you know, there's actually, everything's valid, but he's saying that there is some type of lapse of time that there was between Christ and the Catholic Church, you know?
So,
Peter was Jewish, you know, and this man, I'm like, Peter wasn't Catholic. And I'm like, you know, we can look back at Matthew 6 and 18 and, you know, how Christ actually did told Simon Peter to look, you know, after his sheep and, you know, when he asked them the three questions, you know, maybe he really loves them. So, I'm taking too long, but basically, you know, I'm just trying to clear that out for him. And I'm pretty sure he's going to listen to this podcast for sure.
Okay, good. I hope he does listen. And our Protestant friends are warmly welcomed here.
Everything's under control. Situation normal. We're fine. We're all fine here now. Thank you. How are you?
Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking.
Uno, dos, tres, cuatro tacos. Don't forget the rice and beans on the plato. I like to eat, homie, yo no estoy flaco. Yeah, I'm chubby, pero I'm still guapo. Uno, dos, tres, cuatro.
Patrick Madrid is on
Taco Tuesday.
Coast to coast on Relevant Radio.
Taco Tuesday's my favorite day. That's the reason why I'm more away. Better I don't care, homie, let them hate. I'm just trying to eat another plate.
I like to let this play out. It's good. But we have work to do. Happy Taco Tuesday. Welcome back.
There's a tweet that just came in. This is you like this.
Okay.
It's from Steve. It says, it's a picture of a California license plate that says Taco 911.
Yeah.
And it says, I just saw this on the back of a truck on my way to work while listening to Patrick Madrid. Today is Taco Tuesday.
The planets are aligning.
That's right. This is like seeing a double rainbow. Wow. What does it mean?
That's cool. I'm going to have to go look for that one. Well, thank you for that. So we go from that to this. This is an email that came in a while ago. This is not like from today or anything. It was a while ago, months ago. And it's from Georgia. And it's really to the point. She's listening in Texas. And she says, I can't believe how stupid the retarded statement I heard coming from your stupid mouth. The difference, idiot. They write it to me and I read it.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So this is, thank you, Georgia, in Texas. So she says, I can't believe how stupid the retarded statement is I heard coming from your stupid mouth. The difference, idiot, is that the folks in Ukraine are defending their country. In the U.S., children and innocent people are getting killed. We are not at war. That's all in caps. And it's unrelated to anything that I can think of, but maybe it was about discussing the war in Ukraine back in the spring. But it was so succinct that I thought it deserved to be read on the air. So thank you, Georgia. And I hope you're still listening. This is from Missy. She says, last night, as my husband and I got ready for bed, the glowing smart TV screen caught my eye. It was an ad with an upside down cross showing. So I immediately went in and turned it off to see what on earth was going on. It was an ad for a new Amazon Prime show. And I guess the show has to do with exorcism. I was so upset, she says. We hardly watch TV as it is, but I hate having smart devices like that, which can be on like a screensaver almost and broadcast awful ads that are even of the occult right into my home. I was angry about it, that the cross would be shown in a demonic way. To me, it was righteous anger. My husband suggested that anger might not be the right emotion and I should feel sadness or pity. I felt that there is a time and place for anger, just as Jesus had when he turned over the tables in the temple. I declared that I hate that TV. What are your thoughts? Thank you and God bless you. Well, thank you, Missy. I'm with you. And we're in good company, too, because St. Thomas Aquinas, among others, said that although anger can be a sin and often is a sin, it's certainly not always a sin. And he points out that if you don't have anger about certain things, and like you said, it's a righteous anger, if you don't have anger, you can't change anything. If you don't get angry about something that is unjust or unsafe or spiritually dangerous in some other way, and you'll never take steps to solve it. So anger in itself is not sinful. If it's the kind of anger that leads to the sin of wrath or becomes the sin of wrath, well, that, of course, is a sin. The desire for destruction and punishment and retribution and harm and anger of that kind, sure, that is definitely sinful. In fact, wrath is one of the seven deadly sins. But if you are angry because black people are enslaved by white slave owners, and you're an abolitionist, and you stand up and say, this is wrong, we've got to do something to stop this. Well, that's righteous anger, and that's a good kind of anger. And without that kind of anger, progress doesn't get made, and bad things continue to happen. So I'm with you. It doesn't mean that your husband isn't also right in the sense that you should feel sadness or pity, but if all you feel is sadness and pity and you never bother to do anything about it, well, then that sadness and pity is not going to do anyone any good. So I think you're right to invoke Jesus overturning the tables of the money changers in the temple. Thank you. Let's go to Jesse now in Chicago. Good morning, Jesse.
Good morning, Patrick.
Yes, sir.
I'm sorry. I'm trying to get you off speaker. I got a couple questions very quickly. By what right do I have to say to somebody, may God bless you? I don't feel like I have that authority to invoke God's name to have God bless somebody.
Well, you do. You do because, you know, you're asking something good. What does it say in 1 Timothy chapter 2, beginning in verse 1? He says that I ask for prayers, petitions, supplications, and thanksgivings be offered for everyone. So when you're praying for somebody, what are you doing? You're asking God to bless that person. When you're supplicating for somebody, what are you doing? You're begging God to bless somebody. So to say God bless you is just simply conforming to what the Bible already says to do, and not just there, but in many places, you know, that we ask God to bless other people. So it's entirely good and right. And you do have, I wouldn't say authority or power. It doesn't require authority and power, but you have God's own mandate that you should do that. So no problem about that whatsoever.
Okay. And my second very quick question is, as a Eucharistic minister here in Chicago at St. Julianum's Parish, by canon law, I cannot bless, like, a young child that comes up with their parents, and they almost expect like we should do the sign of the cross. By canon law, I can't as a lay person. Any thoughts on what I
Where
can
did you...
do when?
Okay. Did somebody tell you that? That somebody said that canon law forbids you from doing that?
I thought I had heard it once before on relevant radio.
I can elaborate.
I'm still trying.
I can elaborate. No, let me elaborate, because you might have heard it from me. I just want to make sure that if you did, that what I was saying is clear. I personally, in my understanding of the Church's sacramental theology and the distinction between the lay state, which you and I are in, and the ordained state that the priest is in, he has the sacrament of holy orders, and you and I do not, especially in liturgical celebration. So the liturgical context, which we're talking about here at Mass, it's proper for the priest, and this is true of deacons, it's proper for the priest to impart a blessing. Now, it doesn't have to be just in a liturgical context. It can take place at any time. But in a particular way, during the Mass, to give a blessing is a sacerdotal thing, and that's just a word that means priestly. So lay people do not have that capacity. And this is where, in my view, it is pastorally unwise to have lay people administering blessings of that type when somebody comes up to communion with his arms folded across his chest because he's not going to receive communion, but he's going to receive a blessing. I understand the idea behind it. I just don't think it's a good thing to do because it is a way of clericalizing lay people. And it's a way of blurring the necessary distinction between the action of the priest in the liturgy versus the action and participation of lay people during the liturgy. But nobody consulted me. So as a general principle, I think that's how the Church has handled this question before. Parents can bless their children. There are ways in which you as a lay person can bless other people. But this is different in my view. However, when this issue has come up before, and I forget now who it was, but somebody drew my attention to the fact that in one of the, and this may have been from the general instruction of the Roman Missal, I don't remember because I have to go back and see where this authoritative statement was. But in fact, much to my surprise, there is a line in there that refers to lay people or lay ministers doing this as well. Now, as I read it, it didn't strike me as this is in any way a mandate or an encouragement, but that it can be permitted. So I want to acknowledge that that's present in some sense, and I think it's in the rubrics for the general instruction of the Roman Missal. Nonetheless, even though it's not my prerogative to say what can and can't be done, that's the church's prerogative, nonetheless, I think there have been some things over time that we've seen where the church has pastorally permitted some things that have turned out in retrospect not to be great, not to be helpful. And so I see this as one of them. So it really comes down to you and what you want to do. So if you, as an extraordinary minister of Holy Communion, find yourself in this uncomfortable situation where somebody is there and you're being asked to give them a blessing and you don't feel comfortable with that, well, then I think the thing to do is to say, I can't do this anymore. And maybe you can be a lector or an usher, or you can participate in some other way if you want to. If the priest says when somebody comes forward to receive communion, you can give a blessing. Again, personally, I don't think that's the right way to go, but I'm not in charge, and my opinion is just my opinion. So if it were me and I was serving as an extraordinary minister of Holy Communion, I'm not an extraordinary minister, but if I were, and that was something that came up and I was told, well, I have to give a blessing, I would probably say, well, then I won't be able to participate in this, and I'll find some other way that I can serve. So that's how I would handle it, but you're not obliged to do it that way. I guess that's the best I can tell you, Jesse. I hope that clarifies it further. Thank you. Let's go now back to Jose. We got cut off earlier, Jose, in Chicago. Sorry about that, but welcome back.
Hi, Patrick. So, yeah, just my question was, you know, I have this Protestant friend that we keep going back and forth in regards mm-hmm. to the beginning of the church. So basically what he's telling me is that, you know, it's like a really he believes, or he saw a video where he says that, you know, from Jesus Christ to the beginning of the Catholic Church, you know, there's like a lapse, like something like a time that is not there. He's saying that. But again,
yeah.
I don't know if you could just let him know, or yeah, I don't know if he's going to be listening to this podcast. So if you could just, you know.
And I got cut off when I was trying to answer your very good question earlier. So you didn't cut me off. It just, the gremlins did. So I'll take another run at it. So it's a misunderstanding of church history to make that assertion, because when Jesus said in Matthew 16:18, upon this rock I will build my church and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. You notice he's saying it in the future tense. I will build my church. I will give you, he says to Simon Peter, the keys of the kingdom of heaven. So when did this actually happen? And to assert, as it sounds like your friend is doing, I'm sure it's in good faith, but he's just mistaken, to assert that there was some gap in time within which there really was no church between the time that Jesus ascended to the Father and then some point along the way where the Catholic Church sort of pops up. Historically, that's not true, and it's not difficult to disprove that. So I referenced St. Ignatius of Antioch as an example on another topic earlier on the show today, but let's go back to him for a minute. He was a disciple of St. John, the apostle, who was in the upper room with Jesus when he celebrated the first Mass, the Last Supper. So St. Ignatius, who was a very old man by the time in the year 107, he was being led to Rome to be martyred by being devoured by lions in the amphitheater. He wrote along the way from Antioch, which is like the lower, the southern eastern corner of mainland, what we now would think of as Turkey, and its border with Syria. That's where Antioch is. So he was making the route, making the trip, coming all the way over to Rome, where he would be put to death. And he wrote seven letters, and six of them were to the churches that he passed through along the way. And one of them was to, his name escapes my mind, but it'll come to me in just a minute. But he was one of the other early church fathers who he addressed a letter to. But he's talking in his letters about Catholic things like the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist. He says, and I'm paraphrasing here, if you should meet somebody who does not believe what we teach, that the Eucharist is the very flesh of Jesus that suffered on the cross for your salvation. He says, then stay away from that person. Avoid him because he's teaching something that did not come from the apostles. Well, how would he know? Well, he learned the gospel from the apostle John. He says so. So we know that he received the gospel pure and unadulterated from somebody who would know. That's an apostle. And furthermore, he talks in his epistles about the Catholic Church. He uses the term the Catholic Church. And he ties it together with the bishop and the Holy Eucharist. And he says, again, paraphrasing, he says, you know, let there not be any Eucharist where the bishop is not present. For where the bishop is present, there is the Catholic Church. And so your friend is going to have an impossible time trying to refute the documentary evidence, even just from an historical standpoint, much less the biblical interpretation that the fathers gave to what Jesus said. Because you see the church and you see it being called the Catholic Church at the very beginning, immediately at the close of the apostolic era. So, in fact, what happened was when Jesus ascended to the Father, some days later, the Holy Spirit comes upon the apostles in the upper room. That's the birthday of the church. That's when the church was born, the Catholic Church, capital C. And you see it in seedling form. You see it in its infancy. And you shouldn't expect to see the Catholic Church as it appears now, because like the mustard seed in the tree that a mustard seed grows into, it's one and the same organism, but it's going to look different in its more mature form than it does in its seedling form. So that shouldn't throw him. But what he's seeing in the book of Acts and what he's reading about in the epistles is the first Catholics, the apostles, preaching to the first Catholics, those followers of Jesus, and describing all the things that unfolded from that point forward. Now, the fact that Peter was Jewish is irrelevant. Jesus was Jewish. Peter did not remain Jewish. And this is evidenced by the revelation that God gave to Simon Peter in Acts chapter 10. Rise up, Peter, kill and eat, he was told in a dream. Well, what do you mean? Because he sees this gigantic tarp covered with all kinds of animals, including the Mosaic ceremonially unclean animals. So like pork, pigs, for example, and others. And he's told three times, rise up, Peter, kill and eat. And he asks, well, what do you mean by that? And he realizes that God is revealing to him that the Mosaic ceremonial covenant had passed away. Somebody complained in an email yesterday about supersessionism. That's exactly what happened. There's nothing wrong with supersessionism. What that means is that the gospel supersedes the Mosaic covenant. The Lord himself said he has come to fulfill the law, not to abolish it, but to fulfill it. And the new covenant supersedes now what came before that was only partial and temporary and imperfect, is now replaced by the permanent and the perfect in the new covenant, the sacraments, etc. So what happened is Simon Peter receives this revelation directly from God that those things have passed away now. And so in Acts chapter 15, at the Council of Jerusalem, where this now is being discussed and debated, because there were those among them who were Judaizers who thought that you do have to keep the ceremonial covenants, the ceremonial laws, rather, in order to be a Christian. You had to be circumcised. You had to keep kosher. You had to do all these things. And so the church at that council said, no, you don't have to do those things anymore. That's all passed away. And St. Paul spends a lot of time on this very topic in Galatians, the epistle to the Galatians, the whole thing. So the point is, Simon Peter was no longer a Jew by religion. He was a Jew by culture and by language, and salvation comes from the Jews, we're told in the Bible, but he was now a Catholic. And by the time we get to the early part of the second century, the end of the first century, we already see the word Catholic beginning to be used. And apparently it was already in circulation to some extent, because St. Ignatius of Antioch does not see the need to explain what he means by that. He's using this term, and you'd think if it was something unknown or alien to Christianity, people would say, the what? The what church? What's that? What are you talking about? And nobody did. Everybody understood what he meant by that, even though that's the first extant version we have of the term being used in patristic literature. So the evidence is there. It's inspectable. He can look at it, consider it, but it's not really true. to imagine that there was this gap in time after which or before which the church did not exist. So I'll leave it at that. I hope that's helpful to you, Jose. And I do hope your friend, if he does listen, that he will feel warmly invited to call in anytime. I'd be happy to talk to him directly. I'll be right back. This hour is sponsored by Ave Maria Mutual Funds, where financial goals are aligned with pro-life values and fund decisions are based on investment fundamentals designed to preserve and grow wealth without violating moral beliefs. More information at AveMariaFunds.com.
Patrick Madrid is on Coast to Coast on Relevant Radio.
Now that's what I call a taco.
Get connected to the conversation. Call now, 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now. Relevant Radio.
Hey, I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but I'm really bummed out about this. There was a lot of B's in that sentence. Bearer of bad news, but I'm bummed out. It has to do with white rice. I like white rice. If I go to a Chinese restaurant, I like to have a bowl of white rice. But sorry to say, there was a study that was done, and this was done in Iran, of all places. They did a study of 2,500 people, and they found that eating white rice was bad for your heart, or so they say anyway, because the grains are refined when they're processed into flour or meal, which gives them a finer texture and longer shelf life, but eliminates some of the nutrients. They say, by comparison or contrast, whole grains like brown rice, oats, and whole wheat bread contain the entire grain, so that's why that's good. But basically, what they're saying in this study, and ties in with a report from the American College of Cardiology and the American Heart Association, that white rice, they're saying, can be as bad as candy or refined sugar as far as your heart health is concerned. So I don't know if I like this science because I like white rice. But I have a question, Cyrus. I mean, I don't know if you've ever traveled in Asia. I've traveled in Asia, and rice is a huge part of what they eat in Japan, for example. You know, for breakfast in the morning, if you're ever in Japan, I've been to Japan many times, what do they eat when they get up in the morning? They don't eat cereal. They don't eat toast. They eat rice, and a lot of it throughout the day. It's like our bread, I guess. And I would think that this would be borne out with skyrocketing levels of coronary artery disease among Asians for whom rice is the big part of their diet. And I don't get the impression that that's the case. So I'm not sure what to make of this. What say you, Dr. Simcoe?
First of all, I am not a doctor. I think there will be a study that will prove whatever it is you want to have proven. So I bet there's another study out there.
So if you don't like this study, just wait long enough and another one will come out?
Right. I bet if you Google search the benefits of white rice, lo and behold, there'll be plenty of studies that say you should be eating white rice. That's what I think.
And that study will be from the University of Tokyo.
that's right. Yeah, that is right. Yeah, did this study?
Oh, it's in the article.
A culture when you post it doesn't eat rice, and they probably don't want it imported.
You know, I never thought about that. Yeah. It's possible, but
yeah, my conspiracy theory. I like the white rice. Says, I'm not buying this story.
Yeah, I did see a study that says that red wine is good for you.
Ooh,
so
good. How about dark chocolate?
I've heard that too.
All right, we're good.
That's the kind of science I like.
Yeah, science.
Yes.
what else do we need?
Science. Yeah, I've studied that and I thought, okay, case closed.
Yeah, no more. I don't need to know anything else.
Right. No. I can't hear any other studies. One of them said that red wine is good for you. That's all I need. That's all I want.
Good. Case closed.
Oh, this came in from Mary. Mary's listening in Los Angeles. Hello, Mary, and thank you for writing in to me about the upside down cross. She says, whoa, Patrick, St. Peter was crucified upside down on an upside cross. Not sure where that became defined as demonic, but as Catholic, shouldn't we reject this redefinition? Anyway, I agree with dumping the smart or dumb TV. God bless you and Cyrus and Relevant Radio. Thank you for that, Mary. Appreciate that. No, it's not that. I mean, yes, St. Peter was crucified upside down because he said, I'm not worthy to be crucified in the same way that my Lord was. So they said, okay, we'll turn you upside down. And off he went. So I don't deny that. I mean, why would I? But it is true that the devil, he very often inverts things. So think of a black mass. Nothing wrong with the mass, obviously. But the Satanists, they invert that and they pervert that and they change it into something like as much as they can that's the opposite of the real thing. So it is a real phenomenon that in that world, people who want to promote Satanism, whether they realize it or not, they will take signs and symbols and they will invert them. So an upside down cross is indeed part of that world. I wish it weren't so, but it is. So don't get too concerned about this. And my comment about that earlier has to do with that kind of thing, and not to the exclusion that Simon Peter was crucified upside down. That's true. Thank you. Let's go to Helen now in Providence, Rhode Island. Good morning, Helen.
Good morning. I'm so glad I got on. I've had this question for a long time. When I read Jonah, it sounded like Nineveh turned around and wasn't destroyed.
Right. Mm-hmm. Go ahead. Did we lose her? Oh, I think we lost her. I don't know what happened. Oh, well. So let's see here. Cyrus, help me out.
Yeah, I don't see her.
I don't know what happened to our caller.
I did write her question down real quick. I can.
Okay.
So hopefully she's listening.
You want to try to just run it by me and I'll try to answer it?
Okay. Yeah. So what I got was I heard that Nineveh was destroyed at some point in the Bible after they converted. Is it true? And what did they do to get destroyed?
Well, okay, so that's going to require a bit more looking into that on my part. So why don't I take a rain check on your question? I don't want to try to wing it and say something that is only partial or in some way not the full answer. So let's do that. I will put that on my to-do list, and then we will come back and talk about that at another time. And I guess that's convenient, too, because the caller dropped for whatever reason. Thanks for that. Let's go now to Brandon in Rio Rancho, New Mexico. Hello, Brandon.
Hello, good morning. My question for you is, I know we're encouraged to offer up our daily sufferings to the Lord. Is it appropriate to offer up suffering from grief due to sin?
Sure, yeah. So, for example, just to share a little bit from my own life, for what it's worth, when I receive Holy Communion, one of the things that I pray when I receive Holy Communion is, Lord, that I offer this, the intention of this Holy Communion in reparation for all the sins I've committed and all the sins I've caused other people to commit. And that's because of sorrow for sin. So every time I receive Holy Communion, that's one of my intentions. It's not the only one, but it's always there. So, yeah, I don't think there's any reason why you shouldn't offer that up.
Okay. Would you say there's a difference between, you know, suffering from some kind of tragedy in your family and then offering up that suffering is due to sin by your own fault?
There certainly is a difference. There's no doubt about it. Because if you're the cause of your own suffering due to sin, obviously that's on you. But there's still value. There's still redemptive value in the suffering that you experience from sorrow for sin. And when you offer that suffering to the Lord, it has a purifying effect on you, and it will strengthen you. So it doesn't go to waste. And it doesn't mean as though God is saying, oh, sorry, that's not going to help you because that's your own fault. No, you're suffering from your sorrow for sin. That is very useful in purification. But it's true also that if you're suffering patiently with things that you didn't choose and you didn't cause, that's just another form of suffering that can redound to your benefit as well. But the Lord doesn't reject the suffering that's caused by your own sorrow for sin. Not at all.
Okay.
Mary Magdalene, who is associated, not everybody agrees on this, but is associated with that woman who, when Jesus was dining at the home of a Pharisee, she was weeping over her sins and she crouched at the Lord's feet and washed his feet with her tears and dried them with her hair. I mean, that's abject suffering because of your sins. She was so sorrowful at what she had done. And look at how Jesus praises her for what she did.
Wonderful. Well, thank you very much, sir.
You're welcome, Brandon. Great to talk to you. Thank you. Let's go to Tom now in Boston, Massachusetts. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Patrick. I'm honored to talk with you. I must say your show has been a wonderful guide for me on how to live a Catholic life. And I enjoy listening to you very much.
Thank you.
So my question is, I often have conversations about religious matters with an Episcopal friend of mine, Episcopalian, and he's always saying it's all about the love. And he teases me, saying that I tend to be too much focused on the law. Now, maybe that's part of my personality. But I think what he's also referring to is I often bring up Catholic teaching, some of which I learned from you. And I'm curious how you would suggest I respond to him.
Okay. Well, not having heard exactly everything he said, I can only maybe draw some conclusions and try to respond to what I think he means by that. I would say, number one, don't forget that God is all loving. That's true. He's all merciful, but he's all just as well. So justice, as you and I both know, is getting what you deserve. Mercy, which is from God's love, is getting what you don't deserve. And God is both, and not to the exclusion of the other. And there's no imbalance that we could see here. I think if there were an imbalance, if we could talk about it that way, it's that God desires to be merciful to us, even though we don't deserve that mercy. And yet, and if we don't accept it, of course, his justice is what awaits. So in the Catholic Church, we acknowledge and embrace and are grateful for God's mercy and how he deals so patiently and mercifully with us in and through the sacraments, for example. How merciful it is that the Lord remains with us in the Holy Eucharist. He didn't have to do that. So we can agree with your friend on that point, but it doesn't exclude the fact that there are certain laws that Jesus himself said, I have not come to abolish the law. Or he says that if anyone should teach others to not obey the law, then he's the least in the kingdom of heaven. So God's law, his eternal law, and expressions of that eternal law that we see in things like, for example, the Ten Commandments, those are always, you know, it's perennially true, and it doesn't conflict with God's mercy. So to be aware of God's law and his justice and to seek to live according to his law and his justice is not at all incompatible with mercy. What I would say is, your friend, if he's not careful, and I don't know anything about him, so I can only speculate, but if he's not careful, he might be one of those people to whom Jesus says, why do you say to me, Lord, Lord, but you do not do what I command you? Or the one who says, Jesus says, it's not the one who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven. It's the one who does the will of my Father in heaven. So there's an action component to the Lord's love. He loves you and he wants you to love him in return. And because he loves you, he's showing you here's the pathway to freedom and happiness. And that requires your participation. And that includes don't break God's laws. So if that's something that bothers him or if that's an area of disagreement, then I would say that the way to truly love God and to focus on his love for you is to cooperate with what he says to do and not to. Now, I don't know if I'm hitting the bullseye here, but based on what you said, it kind of makes me wonder if these aren't parts of what your discussion is.
Yeah, I think you hit the bullseye exactly, yes. It's the idea of what I hear you saying maybe in different words is how God teaches us how to love.
Yeah, exactly. So let's take in your home life. Are you married, Tom? Have you had kids?
I am, yes. Okay. And I have two adult children.
Got it. Okay, so in your home life, in family life, mom and dad love the kids, and yet they have rules. You have to do your chores. You have to keep your room clean. You have to do the dishes. You have to take out the trash. We have dinner at 6 p.m., and everybody's supposed to be there. So it's not that the rules are there for the sake of rules, but the rules are there because of the love that you have for your children and for each other. And so the relationship that's based in love is also bound by certain rules. People have certain responsibilities to each other. And there are certain things that we don't do in this family, like we don't lie to each other. We don't steal from each other. We don't. You know what I'm saying? So the rules are not there in the church for the sake of them. They're there because, like in any good family, people have rights and obligations and duties, and the rules are there to help us live a harmonious, happy life so that we can focus on the love without things getting torn apart.
Wonderful. That is very helpful. It is exactly what I was looking for. Thank you very much.
You're welcome, Tom. Very nice to talk to you. I hope it won't be the last time. I'm looking at the clock, and I think I'm going to not have time to take another phone call. So, oh, Cyrus and your toys. I love watching you have fun with the toys. They are fun. And I like that one, too. That's a fairly new one.
We do
that's
it in
keeper.
Mexico all the time.
I know. You want that on your karmic record, I can tell you. So, yeah, it is Taco Tuesday. That's true. So celebrate in whatever way seems right to you. I know what I'm going to be doing. And between now and tomorrow, I'll be praying for you as I always do. If you want to send me an email, just go to relevantradio.com/Patrick. And when you get there, you're going to see just under the show name, you'll see three blue buttons. One says about, one says links, and one says contact. Press contact and you can send me an email. You can also find me on Twitter. If you'd like to interact with me there, I'll be on the lookout for you. So until tomorrow, I'll pray for you. Please pray for me. God bless you.
Can I get a beef taco, please?
Oh, we don't do that here, sir. Can I offer you our vegan gluten-free broccoli tacos with cashew cheese?